Good evening. My name's Paul, and ho, 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 I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. Alcoholics always say that. They're glad to be anywhere. And I'm a little self-conscious in that a number of people, several people anyway, have heard me before, and I feel like I ought to get a new story. But I was afraid I wouldn't get back in time for the meeting. So I guess the people that have heard me before will get a lesson in patience and tolerance. And I'll talk to the newcomers. I'm impressed with how many newcomers are here. I'm always impressed with this meeting. I love this meeting. This meeting has, every AA meeting has its own personality. And I like people, and I like some people better than others, and I like some meetings better than others. And so I'm glad to be here, and I'm always glad to see newcomers. I read someplace on a paper, like the box 459 or something. I read that something, and I left it on my dresser to look at it periodically until I really, really remembered what it said, and because I was so impressed with the words they used. And it was saying that Bill W., one of the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, said, Bill W. said, that carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was our primary aim and the chief reason for our existence. And I thought, God, those are strong words. Our primary aim and the chief reason for our existence. And then and he said, our existence, does he mean us as individuals or us as groups or both? But at any rate, it's a big, big deal, carrying the message. And we do that by, in a thousand ways. Do it by having meetings and talking to each other and talking to the newcomers. And we do it just by staying sober out there in the drinking society. And we do it in many ways. But one of the favorite ways for all of us is talking to newcomers. And so that's why we're always so glad you're here. And I often said that I'd keep coming back to AA, even if it wasn't keeping me sober, just to watch what happens to the newcomers. And we all feel that way. We're really glad you're here. In fact, we're so glad you're here that we don't care whether you're glad you're here. As a matter of fact, if you're really glad to be here, and if you're just really, really glad to be here, and you're just so happy, 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 we may not be able to help you. At least not until you get off whatever you're on. But if you don't want to be here, and you don't belong here, and you're not one of us, and especially if your case is different, bad news is that makes you one of us. So you might as well try the program on for size. One of many things I like about AA is that they don't charge you any extra if you enjoy it. And this is a good group to come to enjoy it. And another group I'd like to welcome, I didn't hear anything about court cards at this meeting, which I think is entirely appropriate because court cards aren't really a part of AA, but we sometimes provide that service to take care of get well cards from the judge. And but I've been conscious of the court cards ever since I talked at a meeting in Riverside, and the meeting must have been close to a courthouse or something. And when you talk, you have to sit up at the front table with the secretary. And there's nothing to do until you are called up to talk. And so there was a basket, and the court cards were in it. And I sat there and counted the court cards. And there were 21 court cards at that meeting. But only one newcomer. Ever since that, I've kind of gotten the habit of welcoming the non-alcoholic drunk drivers. We're really glad you're here. I personally hope you stay here till I get home. Anyhow, I did drink. I loved the readings. Ed did a marvelous job of the traditions, which kind of disappointed me a little bit, because I like to listen to the errors. I like the way chapter 5 was screwed up. Reminded me of the time an older woman was reading that, and she read it as, "What an ogre." I myself one time was reading the tradition, the chapter, and then I read it as thought through prayer and meditation. I remember, but one of the traditions I like best is the fellow that was reading it and said, "The only requirement for membership is the desire to start drinking." That makes more sense than the way it's written. I was at a meeting last night, and the guy read it as, he was reading chapter 3, and he said, "Among the things we have tried was drinking in the morning." And he left out the not drinking in the morning. I had something we could add to the list. Things that didn't work. I was, long before I became an alcoholic, I had a lot of problems, emotional problems, all kinds of problems. And I was reading a medical journal, and it was an article on how carbon dioxide inhalations were good for the treatment of psychoneurosis. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting, because carbon dioxide is the thing that makes you breathe, not lack of oxygen that makes you, that keeps you from, you can't hold your breath long enough to commit suicide, if you may have noticed that. It's not lack of oxygen that makes you breathe, it's the accumulation of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide makes you breathe, and that's why if you keep rebreathing in a paper bag or whatever and breathing the same air, the carbon dioxide accumulates and you have to breathe more and more and more. I'll send you all a consultation fee on this respiratory physiology I'm telling you about. But when you breathe carbon dioxide gas, it stimulates your breathing, and the harder you breathe, the more carbon dioxide you're breathing in, which makes you breathe harder and harder and harder, and eventually it gets to where the lights are flashing and the lightning's going off and the bells are ringing and the noise in your head. And eventually your brain explodes and you lose consciousness. And I thought, God, that ought to cure something. And I was desperate to get out of where I was, so I decided I would try that, but I didn't want to go to any doctor and tell them I was neurotic and I wanted carbon dioxide inhalations. And besides, I'd read the article and I knew as much as he did about it as anybody else would. So I called the gas company and ordered, not the gas company you use, I called up the gas company to order a tank of carbon dioxide gas, and they bring up this big truck and a big tank of gas, about so big around, must weigh about 250 pounds, and it has it on a dolly and brings it up to the front door of the house and says, "Where do you want this?" And I said, "Well, the head of the bed in the master bedroom, where would you think?" Had a valve on the top and a hose and a mask. And but what I had now was to find, I could give myself a treatment, but I needed somebody to turn it off. So I go to Max, he's in the front room watching TV, and I tell him I'm going to take this treatment, and I'm going to put this mask on, I'm going to breathe this gas, I'm going to breathe harder and harder, I'm going to breathe faster and faster, and all kinds of lights are going to flash, and the bells are going to ring, and my brain's going to explode, and I'm going to lose consciousness. And when I do that, would you come in and take the mask off and turn the gas off? And she said, all right. So I guess it's the next commercial. He came and turned it off. I don't know. Anyway, he'd add that to the list of things that didn't work. I kept on drinking. And I ended up in the nut ward. That's where I ended up. But I was there by mistake. Because I was a diagnostician. Here I was losing weight, having daily headaches, sense of impending insanity. I'd had convulsions twice. In fact, I was under the treatment of the best neurologist in Orange County, who was giving me Dilantin and phenobarbital for epilepsy. He didn't know why I had convulsions. He didn't think to ask me if I drank. I didn't think to tell him. I thought, I need a good diagnostic workup. Well, I happened to be the best diagnostician I knew. So I did some lab work on me, and I did a bit of a physical exam on me, and I sat down and had a consultation with me. And I went over the convulsions and the weight loss and the sense of impending insanity and the headaches. And God, it was obvious. I had a brain tumor. Nothing funny about a brain tumor. He sent me off to the Mayo Clinic, and it was about this time of the year, your Christmas time of 1966. And a bad place to go at Christmas. A Mayo Clinic might be a good place, but not at Christmas time. Because if you end up on the nut ward, they make you go and ice Christmas cookies. I hate the ice Christmas cookies. I remember the gal in white taking me down the hall to the Christmas cookie party and near my hand in the ice cream and smash it onto a cookie. And I don't know how many cookies we crumbled before I told her what she could do with her cookies. I went back to my cell, by God. I wasn't going to be told what to do. I don't like a... I've never liked icing Christmas cookies. When I was a little kid, back in Lyons, Ohio, my older sister had a real fetish about Christmas. Every year, we had to have a Christmas cookie icing contest. And she would make cookies, and Santas, and sleighs, and Christmas trees, and angels, and reindeers, and all that stuff, and all different colors of icing, and then all kinds of sprinkles to put on the top. And then we'd have a contest to see who could icing the prettiest Christmas cookie. I did not like icing Christmas cookies when I was a little kid back in Alliance, Ohio. And I didn't like icing Christmas cookies when I was a big strong doctor on the nut ward of the Mayo Clinic. And there I was. I ended up... in the nut ward of St. Joseph's Hospital, called the Rush Center. Not because people are rushing to get in. They didn't have Christmas cookies. They had that much in their favor. But they were fanatics on leather belts. You had to learn to make the leather belt. That's part of the program. I'm sure that if they had a Senate investigation or something, they'd find out their people have been there for years. They won't let them out until they make a leather belt or ashtray or something useful. And they're fanatics on it. They try to convince me that the quality of my life would improve if I learned how to make leather belt. I couldn't understand the philosophy, and I didn't understand the instructions. Which of course was the fault of that occupational therapist, because I've always known if you don't understand things well enough, you can explain it to me so that I understand things you don't understand as well as you're supposed to. She had explained it to me three times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a fourth time. I was sitting there commiserating with myself about the series of misdiagnoses and mistakes, and poor medical management, bad breaks to a nice guy like me that ended up in a place like that. And while I was thinking on these thoughts, this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't see that my problems were strictly marital walked up behind me and wanted to know if I'd be willing to talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God Almighty, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? But I could tell by looking at his face that he thought it was a good idea. And happiness on a nut ward, I'll tell you this, happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I was willing to go to any length to make him happy. And so I said, okay. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room, yelling at the top of his voice, "My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Ha, 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 ha." I was embarrassed for him. He told his whole story, an interminable story. I don't remember a word of it, except the ending. I remember he ended by saying, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along?" And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it, but I'll go, because I figured you'd go back and squeal to that dumb psychiatrist." And he would have, too. And we went off to meeting. I don't know what meeting we were at. I don't know how many meetings we were at before I knew what meeting I was at. But I know that meeting had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He had a change of personality after that meeting. He was suddenly really interested in my case. He wanted to know, what's this about a book? What's this about steps? What's this about meetings? How often do they have meetings? What other kind of meetings do they have? How often do you go to a meeting again? And I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. So I wanted to go to meetings, every meeting I could. I got talking to Frank about that, and Frank took me every night. And finally got enough brownie points, got discharged from the hospital. I had no intention of going back. Why would I go back? I wasn't an alcoholic. Problem was that Max, who isn't an alcoholic, liked the meetings. In fact, once I found out she liked him, then if she wouldn't act right, I decided I wasn't going to go to AA anymore. Right. I said that once too often, and she did, but she's not even an alcoholic. We lived in Anaheim, and we went to meetings in Laguna Beach, so we wouldn't run into anybody we knew, and she couldn't drive the freeways, she couldn't drive to Laguna Beach from Anaheim, but she did. She got in the car, and she'd drive down to Laguna Beach and go to AA meeting. Have you ever tried that? On a Saturday night, sitting at home, drinking, while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? I thought it was very rude. I had to go back to the meeting to find out what the alcoholics were laughing about. And I did that. I did that for 7 months. I've never had a slip. I found an easier, softer way, I think. I just kept on drinking between meetings until I went 7 months to meetings, and finally I went to one meeting too many, and I turned into a mild, very mild, very mild alcoholic. almost a non-alcoholic. In fact, when I first became an alcoholic, I had a list of things that I was. I was more allergic to alcohol. But I wasn't a drunkard, wasn't a wino, wasn't a lush, certainly wasn't a skid row bum. But I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. I have a weird and peculiar reaction to alcohol. when I drink, I can't control how much I drink once I drink. In fact, I can't control my actions, my thinking, my speech, my walking, talking, anything. I can't guarantee my behavior in any respect once I start drinking, which is not my basic problem. My basic problem is that I can't keep from taking that first drink. How intense would be if you knew all that happened when you drink? Well, just don't drink it. But I, of myself, can't keep from taking the first drink. And here I am now, an alcoholic. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, at the bottom of the social barrel. Ashamed to be here. Ashamed to have them out there know I'm here. Ashamed to have you know I'm here. And yet I'm an alcoholic, and you guys are staying sober, and I'm still drinking. And I thought, with all that sense of failure, I thought, my God, see, if I don't even succeed at this, I'm really nothing. And I decided I had to succeed in AA. In fact, they used to, at that time, heard it a lot, stick with the winners, stick with the winners, stick with the winners. You want to make it in the program, stick with the winners. I thought, well, what's a winner? And so I asked Chuck C., who had been sober 100 years or so. I said, what's a winner? And I was surprised when he had to think about it for a minute. And finally he said, well, I guess you have to die sober. And I thought, die sober? I thought, well, screw that. I don't like any accolades I have to die to get. And I'll be a successful member of AA. And over the years, I didn't say this to anybody else. I made the commitment to myself. I'm going to be a successful member of AA. And over the years, I've changed my definition of successful member a little bit. But I don't know any successful member should drink or take drugs. And so that's my basic criteria. And to this day, I still use that. When I have to make a decision as to what course to take or what to do, it used to be I would think, well, now if I do this, they'll do that. But if I do that, then they'll do this. But maybe I ought to do something different, or they'll do something. And that's a manipulation when I get to thinking about that. And I try to avoid that. I do avoid that today. I'm more likely, in order to decide what course to take, I ask myself, what would a successful member of AA do? What would an AA winner do? What would God want me to do? What's the loving thing to do? And all of which are basically the same question. And I feel that if I do a thing for the right motive and leave the results up to God, it turns out the way it's supposed to. And then I don't have any of that happening. And if I have a good attitude and leave the results up to God, things turn out the way they're supposed to. And love is always the right attitude. And almost always I have more than one motive, but I'm the one that decides what's my basic motive, what's my chief motive. If I do a thing for the right motive and leave the results up to God, turns out the way it's supposed to. And that's reminds me of the third step, which I really love the third step. I've always liked that. I like living by all the steps, but I've made a big deal out of the third step in my life. The third step, for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, the third step says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And the third step prayer says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. On awakening in the morning, I like to say that serenity prayer, third step prayer, seventh step prayer. And at breakfast, Max and I will say those prayers, and we read some stuff in a period of silence. And then during the day, when I'm going to do something that's at all frightening, I'll often say the third step prayer and modify it. And in fact, it's like some people have asked me, do you still get nervous when you're going to talk? And I said, well, I don't think of it as nervousness. I think of it as anticipatory anxiety. And I say the third step prayer, and I modify it. And I say, God, I offer myself and this situation to you to do with as you wish. I would like to have it turn out phenomenally successful. But if you have it in your mind that you'd like for me to make a complete ass of myself, well, at least one of us will have a good time. This may be the night. But as I think I said, the first time I did the third step, I said the third step and the third step prayer on my knees in front of my sponsor. And I thought, it's a contract. It should be dealt with as a contract. And I thought, well, it would be easy for either one of us to break that. Maybe it would be easier to enforce it if we had more witnesses. So I went before each of my then three home groups, and I publicly stated the third step and the third step prayer. And I thought that, I felt better after that. But then I thought, that's still just a verbal contract. I'd like to see something in writing. So I went down to a business supply store, and I bought a blank form for setting up a limited partnership. And I filled it out, and I gave God a 51% controlling interest in my life. And he became the general partner, and I became the limited partner. And I felt better about that. But then I realized that all that shows is that a limited partnership exists. But it doesn't show what are the terms of the partnership. And who's responsible for what? Or if a problem comes up, how is this supposed to be solved? Have it in writing before the problem comes up. So I got a paper, there's a line down the middle. On one side I put down what's his responsibility, on the other, what's my responsibility. And what it narrowed down to is that he's in charge of worry, and I'm in charge of work. And he doesn't like for me to even help him with the worry. And he never does a damn bit of the work. And I tell him, I said, I'll pedal and you steer. And for God's sake, watch where you're going. Because I don't like some of the places we've been. That's been working out pretty well for me. It's been working out quite well. Right now I have a slight pause because you're sitting there very quiet. I'm really impressed with how quietly you've been sitting and attentively, and I appreciate that. But I have more people in my head than are in this room. And they're nowhere near as orderly as you are. Because they're busy talking all the time. They talk. That's what they do. They talk. They just talk. They never do any work. They just talk. If I give them caffeine, then they really talk. Very sensitive to all chemical things. And one of them up there started saying that I ought to talk about something, a certain thing. And before I could even analyze it, one of them over here said, no, I ought to be talking about something they want to talk about. And before I talk about that, the third one was fighting among themselves. And pretty soon they're fighting among themselves as to which one of the things I'm going to listen to and talk about that they're suggesting. And it's really very distracting. I'm thinking, shut up there. And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say.
They just
run my life. They have an opinion on everything. And whoever, my life depends on who of the people up there I listen to. There's one of them up there that no matter what it is, if it's the least bit strange, if it's anything we haven't done a lot of times before, that they're the least bit they're afraid of it. They say, oh my God, don't do that. You'll screw it up and they'll all laugh at you. And you want to lead a meeting? No. You want to read it to me? No. Speak to me? No, no. Sponsor something? Oh, no, no. Don't sponsor something. It really ticks me off when somebody I'm working with says, somebody asked me to be their sponsor. And I said, well, what did you say? And they said, oh, I said, no. I said, why did you say no? I said, I don't think I know the program well enough. I said, what the hell do you want to do? Go to sponsorship school? You learn to be a sponsor by sponsoring. You learn to read by reading. You learn to talk by talking. And anyhow, get away from that. But there's another one up in my head, just as loud a voice, yeah, just as loud a voice now, than used to be, but it is now, that says, you know, man, as long as you got this program, you can go anywhere and do anything. You can face anybody and do whatever you want, and nobody can harm you. No one does it. Just as loud a voice, yeah, just as loud a voice now than used to be, but it is now, that says, you know, man, as long as you got this program, you can go anywhere and do anything. You can face anybody and do whatever you want, and nobody can harm you. There's no way anybody can harm you except by making you take a drink. And with this program, nobody can make you take a drink. And it gives me a great deal of confidence to know that. And there's one up there that's always finding fault with Max. He loves him. He's been obsessed with her as long as we've known her. He just watches her all the time. And he's constantly watching her and reporting back to me. And yet there's another one up there just as obsessed with her, and he thinks she's just terrific. He thinks she's got a great sense of humor, she's attractive, and he just thinks she's wonderful, and he's always telling me just how great she is, likes to remind me that she kept going to AA when I didn't want to. And my relationship with Max doesn't depend on what she does, it depends on which of the two guys up there I listen to. And in fact, my life is based on who I listen to up there. But that way, it's been that way all along, except I didn't know that. There's one up there that no matter what the situation, whether it's too hot, or it's too cold, or too crowded, or too lonely, or a happy occasion, or a sad occasion, no matter what it is, his suggestion is always the same. Let's have a drink. I used to think it was a command from God or something. Every time he took a drink, we all got drunk. In fact, the things that I have to listen to, so many of the things are illegal, and a lot of them are lewd, and you may not like what you're having to listen to, but that's nothing compared to what I've got to listen to. You got the easier part of this rule, I'll tell you. I'm glad you can't hear what I got to listen to. And what I started to say was, this is fascinating to me. It's been a great discovery of mine. In the midst of all that noise and confusion and all those people and all that chaos, in the very, very center of me, there's a center of absolute calm. And that's where my higher power is. And that's where he's always been. But I didn't know that. And not knowing it is similar to having it not be true. But now I know that wherever I go, my higher power is there with me and is available. And I used to fight the nice concern about being able to sleep or not being able to sleep. If anything drove me to drink, it was fighting to get to sleep. And now, when I awaken in the middle of the night, it's more of a feeling of my higher power nudging me awake and say, hey, let's talk. And I spend the time, I can't do daytime meditation, like what's it, seven-step prayer says thought through prayer and meditation. Well, that's not true, I can't do it. I can meditate for 5-10 seconds. And one of the people in my head will say, hey, how come everybody's so quiet around here? Now, I decided if I can't meditate during the day and I'm awake at night, why don't I meditate at night? So I do meditations through the night. And I decide I'll either be a good sleeper or a good meditator. And I'm a bit of both now, and it's working out real well for me. They're having a conference. Somebody was saying, showing me a computer program that makes charts. I mean, you put data in the computer with this program and it makes beautiful charts, a pie chart or a bar graph and color and notations, beautiful thing. And I thought, if I had a giant computer and I put all the facts of my life into it, with this program, what would a graph of my life look like? And I've become convinced that it would be a giant V. Similar, I guess, to the Jelinek chart, if you're familiar with that. But it would be a giant V. That my life started way, way over there, and it's going to end way, way, way over there. And from where it started until July 31st, 1967, it was on a downhill course. Now, it wasn't a straight line down, it was ups and downs. Just enough ups to keep me thoroughly confused. Every time I went down, it was downer than the time before. Kept on going down until it ended up in the nut ward of the hospitals on the staff bunk. That wasn't bad enough. I had to go to AA. Had 7 months of AA, and on July 31st, 1967, I accepted the fact that I, of all people, and even though I had no choice in the matter, had nothing to do with it, I really was a mild alcoholic. And you know, from that moment on, my life's been getting better and better. Been getting better and better and better, and today it's better than it's ever been. It's higher on this side than it's ever been on this side, and it's still on its way up. And as far as I can determine, as far as I can see, the only thing that determines how high that can go is how long I can stay around doing the things I'm doing, or doing even more of the things I'm doing that's keeping it on an uphill course. Now, it's not a straight line up, it's up and down. There's down periods in it. But when it drops down, there are dozens of things that I can do to get it to go back up. Call another, a newcomer, work with a newcomer, call another alcoholic, read the book, call my sponsors, go to more meetings, start more meetings, with all kinds of stuff. Or nothing, just wait. If we wait, it'll get better. Winnie E. used to say that. When she said, when things go down and you have a bad period in your recovery, it's the only Bible quote she ever used. She said, the Bible says, and it came to pass. The Bible does not say, and it came to stay. If we just wait, if we don't drink and just wait, it'll get better. We'll get better. In fact, I'm convinced that when people like us hurt, when people like us hurt, we either drink or grow. And we can't come out of a problem the same as we went into it. It seems to me we're spiritually either worse off or better off, depending on whether or not we drink or use drugs. If we just walk through it, get to the other side, by whatever means, without using drugs or alcohol, we're better off spiritually than we were when we went into it. And I guess the book says something like that, about pain is the touchstone of all of our recovery. But anyhow, the thing that impresses me so much is the point of the V. The fact that incidentally, I said it was very mild alcoholic, but now that once I accept the fact that I was an alcoholic, I'm much more alcoholic today than I was then. I'm much more alcoholic. I mean, when they talk about it being a progressive disease, they're not kidding. It's even progressing in recovery. The nice part about it is, it's a progressive recovery. And so they've both been getting better. So I'm much more alcoholic today than I was then. But the thing that, as I say, that impresses me is that one act of acceptance changed the course of my life from getting progressively worse to getting progressively better. Well, when that's so obvious, then I think back, well, you know, as smart as I am and as good looking, why did it take me all those years to accept that one reality? And the only reason, the only thing I can see about it is the reason I wouldn't accept my alcoholism is because I didn't approve of being an alcoholic. I was confusing acceptance with approval. I thought if I accept it, that will look like I approve of it. And I did not approve of me being an alcoholic. And because I did not approve of being an alcoholic, I didn't accept being an alcoholic. And because I didn't accept being an alcoholic, I couldn't do anything about it. Which I think is the key. That acceptance is not weakening. Acceptance is empowering. Because once we accept the reality of a situation, then we have a choice as to what we're going to do about it. But until I accepted, I had no choice. I had no choice. And it's profound to me that I just wonder what my life would be like if I went through life on a daily basis without even considering the fact of whether or not I approve of something. Because nothing has ever changed just because I don't approve of it. I mean, what was it? Somebody, Howard P. was quoting a friend of his who said that on a daily basis, however life is, he tries to love that because that's the way it's going to be anyway. And hating it only makes it worse. Hating it makes it worse, and loving it and accepting it. When we accept it, we have choices as to what we're going to do about it. I hope we can all go through the holiday season and the next year and with accepting life as it comes along without being concerned about the approval part, without holding back because of not approving and having to pout about it or whine about it or complain about it, but just accepting life on life's terms. God, I'm seeing so profound here, I'm getting sick of hearing me. I guess the point is, our job is to enjoy life, whether we like it or not. Thank you all very much.